and it's in the breaking. We come unbound. And it's in the giving. We are found. Yeah. You can barely change.
Welcome to A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, a podcast dedicated to the telling of authentic stories and the sharing of insightful wisdom, exploring science and spirituality, medicine and Mother Nature. No topic is off limits when it comes to growing our personal understanding and supporting our collective well-being. With your host, Dr. Rob Abbott, a family medicine resident practicing spiritually focused and evolutionarily informed functional medicine, we hope to nourish your being so that you can flourish in whatever the moment has called for you to do. And I know you try.
In episode 10 of A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, I have perhaps my deepest, most personal, yet somehow most playful conversation to date with my mentor in integrative and spiritually engaged family medicine, Dr. Gregory Gilbert. As you will hear in the podcast, it was by amazing chance and beautiful synchronicity that Greg and I crossed paths, quickly becoming colleagues, friends, and family beyond measure. From sharing a room together during a mission trip to Haiti, to holding a space for healing alongside Greg's patients, I have been tremendously blessed to have worked and learned from Greg's incredible wisdom and his faithful, giving heart. In this conversation, or should I say, this storytelling, you will hear much of Greg's fascinating background, his undeniable humor, and his amazing dedication to restoring health for those in his community, no matter their socioeconomic background or ability to pay. Digging into the details of the show, we explore the ways in which Greg incorporates spirituality into his clinical encounters with patients. Can doctors really ask the deeper questions of one's faith alongside such inquiry into one's dietary, movement, and sleeping habits? The concept of the bubble, the impenetrable space where clinician and patient can reside, seeking to relieve suffering and promote flourishing. As we dig further, Greg shares countless stories of life as an osteopathic physician, serving in underserved communities, trying to figure out exactly what was the patient's real reason for coming. And in the end, Greg opens his heart to share a personal and vulnerable story of error and forgiveness that will leave your heart yearning to forgive as well, perhaps forgiving those that have hurt you to your core. I will simply stop here and share again how grateful I am to call Greg a mentor, a friend, a father. And I hope you can find some nourishing stories embedded in our playful yet deep conversation, leading you to live a life more open, more fulfilled, and undeniably free. Enjoy the show.
Thank you, Greg, for having this conversation with me today. We're actually, funny enough, sitting on your couch, which feels entirely the proper place to be holding this conversation. And so thank you for welcoming me into your home. And I guess just to start off, how about you let our audience know who you are, what it is that you do, and maybe perhaps how we've even brought ourselves to be here today.
I'm Greg Gilbert. I'm an osteopathic family physician trained in Philadelphia in North Carolina, and then practiced in rural North Carolina for 4 years, and I've been in Charlottesville really since 89. And my practice has evolved over the years from a very traditional internal medicine slash obstetrics slash pediatric practice to more of focusing on what the person actually needs, what's the actual reason for them coming, addressing their medical problems as they see it, as well as the issues that I think are even more important and deeper. And you and I were chatting this morning at coffee. By the way, we have a little group of anywhere from 6 to 10 men who get together once a week at a coffee place in town here in Charlottesville and just chat. And the conversation may be about motorcycles. It might be about God specifically Jesus Christ. It may be about medical or what's going on with our families at the moment. So it's a free-for-all, and it's all in confidence and confidential. And it's one of the hours that I look forward to every week. So since that coffee meeting this morning, Rob and I raced back to my house, me on my bicycle, Rob in his car, and it's about a 2 mile ride, and there must be 7 or 8 stoplights between here and there. And in all confession, I ran about 4 stoplights to try to beat Rob, but I didn't. He actually got here about 30 seconds ahead of me, but by the time he, you know, got out of his car, et cetera, I was waiting for him. Anyway, so where I am now. There's a guy named Ed Chahedi, who was the head of the family medicine program at Carolina at UNC. Years ago, he came up with a term called the ARC, and the ARC is the actual reason for coming. And in simple terms, and this is a real story, I was seeing a guy for strep throat, 35-year-old, and you know, it could have been a 2-minute visit, basically. And this is the kind of thing that most of us can do in our sleep. Yeah, you need amoxicillin, 250 TID for 10 days, and I'll send in the script for you. And away he goes. The examination is probably 30 seconds, and that's it. But even 20 years ago, I was thinking, you know, why did this happen to you? And so within a couple minutes, it was pretty obvious. I said, you know, sometimes when we get infections or even injuries, there's something that caused it, not just the bacteria of streptococcus, but, you know, something in the way you're living your life that might have influenced your immune system at this particular moment. Oh, yeah, last weekend I was the pit crew boss for, I won't mention his name, but because I forgot it, but it was one of the NASCAR racers who was well-known, Dale Earnhardt, there we go, I'll mention his name, and his engine blew in the last lap. So in other words, I could even understand that piece that he lost the race. And I said, well, that's stressful, because you damn right it is. So that's a simple scenario that it really could be played out every day in any medical practice. What happens in more often, however, is person's in for a general checkup. And I go through the review of systems that we're all taught in medical school and go through family history and medications, past medical history, those sorts of things, and then his own chief complaints, whatever they might be. But then in taking the history, eventually in that 45-minute conversation and visit, I bring up, so did you grow up with any kind of spiritual life, any kind of religious beliefs? And this is a fairly liberal town. People are from all over the world. And traditionally in the practice, then some will say, oh yeah, I grew up Presbyterian and I still go to the Presbyterian church here in town. Or I grew up Jewish, but we're really cultural Jews. And so I didn't really practice even as a kid. And I don't anymore. Some people actually say, but this is fairly rare, like, why are you asking me this question? So it's curious to me right off the bat that people don't say, well, wait a minute, I came here for a physical. What are you talking about? Like, do I go to church? Do I go to synagogue? Or do I go to whatever? And yet, most people think, okay, I guess this is part of the physical. I'm going to answer as honestly as I can. I remember one person I asked if he grew up with any spiritual life or if he had any spiritual life now. And he said, my computer. And this was like, again, about 15 years ago. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He goes, well, I work 12 hours a day, 6-7 days a week in front of my computer. And maybe I wasn't as curious or as talented at leading this conversation as I might be now, but I didn't know where to go with that, to be honest with you. I kind of stopped and I had to change the subject. There was too long of a pause for me to sit there quietly and wonder, oh, what do I say next to that? However, most people acknowledge that they had something growing up. Even if it was atheism, they'll admit that that's my spirituality. I don't have any. And what I find is that it's really easy to introduce the topic. And first of all, I have to tell you myself that I'm pretty ecumenical in my beliefs. I personally follow Jesus Christ. My father was Jewish growing up, and he converted. So I have a lot of affection for Judaism. And in my prayer room, which I haven't talked about yet, but is also an exam room, I have a copy of the Quran, which I purchased the Wednesday after the Tuesday 9/11. And I have Tibetan prayer flags and Sufism icons, Catholicism icons. And so I come from a pretty broad background, and my own personal beliefs, even though I hold true to my own faith, is that people should at least be seeking something. And there's plenty of good studies to show that any belief in anything that's not purely straight out satanical, that's destructive, that is, any belief is going to lead us to a more centered life, a more intentional life, and a belief that there's something greater than my own little life here on East Market Street. And those studies are in numerous books with titles that indicate the connection between spirituality and medicine, and others that are just mentioned almost parenthetically. One of my favorite people is Harold Koenig. He's a psychiatrist at Duke University. I heard him speak at VCU in Richmond probably 20 years ago. And he quoted one study that's so easy to remember that even I can. And the study was people entering the university hospital in Durham for hip replacement. He asked them one question, yes or no, do you believe in God? And he could show us that over 200 or 300 patients that were in the study, that those who answered, yes, I do believe in God, did have a better outcome. No, they didn't have zero complications, or they didn't walk out of the operating room on their own accord and leave the hospital that day, but their complication rate was statistically lower. Their rate of needing medications following, like antibiotics for infections, was lower. Their requirement for pain medication was lower, and they left the hospital, let's say, 0.2 days earlier than the average person who said no. So if somebody challenges or just asks me, why do you ask, I'll mention that particular study because it's pretty easy to understand. The others are certainly sometimes more complicated, but these are also studies published in peer-reviewed journals. So that's basically where I start, is what do you believe, what don't you believe, does it influence your life? And then finally, in the future, would you like me to address where you're at spiritually as events come up? And if they ask me more, I'll say, well, let's say 5 years from now your father dies. Would you like me to incorporate into the conversation something about your belief system? So again, I'm kind of laying the groundwork for the future relationship that I have with that individual. And it's curious that even if we're sitting in one of my 5 exam rooms that has something spiritual on the walls, particularly in my prayer room, which is totally different spiritual, the conversations will often go there a lot faster. And I'd be curious to do a study to see where our conversations go and how quickly, just based on icons and, if you will, decorations within an exam room. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
You know, I've seen everything that you've just described play out in these exam rooms, in the prayer rooms, and I don't think I can't go any further in this conversation until, you know, completely explain how we even met each other and came to share that space. And, you know, I'm really grateful for a friend who at the time was a third-year medical student who you were mentoring and working with. And she sent me this really funny email saying, hey, there's this guy, Greg. He works at this clinic down here. I've been doing my clerkship with him. And you guys need to just meet each other. He's probably like your twin. Like, well, you know.
She's right.
You know, as I know, she's actually a twin as well. She's like, well, you know, I'm an actual friend. She's like, yeah, well, he's your third twin. And so I send a, you know, this kind of curious just email to Greg because she had, you know, told me, hey, he's a Christian like yourself, very spiritually focused, very integrative in his approach to wellness and very much in alignment with your process. And at the time, I'd kind of been living in my own silo, a little bit of a bubble. I'd kind of kept my functional medicine, my spirituality, you know, my overall integrative approach to just a very dull internal dialogue. I hadn't found anyone who completely accepted it, and I couldn't completely own it myself. It was all very new. And in reaching out to you, I immediately felt, I think you responded in like 2 minutes or something ridiculous.
Probably.
Like, we need to hang out. Let's have, you know, coffee. And even before that first encounter, I knew I was already accepted for whatever I brought. And you could already tell by, you know, what I had shared in the email that I was bringing a sense of spirituality, a very different approach than maybe many students you had worked with. But instantly felt accepted. And yeah, saw firsthand as I started to work with you, as you asked these questions about spirituality, the response was not, why are you asking me that question? It was actually one of complete reception. And it's amazing to think that on paper, you go to the doctor because you have medical issues. So I should have, you know, I should be asking you medical questions. Yet people weren't responding in complete disagreement or complete surprise to the questions about spirituality. There was something deeper within them, maybe unconscious, that they knew this was right.
Right.
This was a, you know, another human being wanting to connect at a deeper level. And it just felt right. So I'm going to answer honestly and as truthfully about who I am and what I believe, kind of feeling that energy. And, you know, you can put as many icons and, you know, Tibetan prayer flags on the walls, but it really, to me, boiled down to your energy that you brought, that space of acceptance. You,
right.
You held a space where people would feel able to share, to respond. Exactly. And, you know, sometimes we need some visual cues to know it's okay.
It's okay.
You know, it's okay. But it was the first time I'd ever really been able to let loose just wanting to ask those questions of deeper spirituality, letting myself delve into aspects of lifestyle medicine. And I, you know, to this day, I'm really grateful to have found you. And, you know, it's kind of the reason why we're sharing this conversation,
right,
is to really get out there, because I know many people in this audience, and I mean, so many people want to have these conversations with their doctors, with the people closest to them, but it oftentimes just feels, you know, they don't feel that acceptance. They don't feel the safe energy, and it just creates this awkward bubble. And,
right,
you know, I would love for you to explain, you know, maybe through a story or how this process for you of holding that space came about, maybe early on some of the difficulties, or what was it that clicked to you that it made sense to talk about spirituality in the exam room?
Thanks. It happens, one is innately, I just believed that from the beginning that this was an important piece. And then this conference I went to of Harold Koenig's and several other people, Sam Worthington, who writes about forgiveness, that I realized how powerful spirituality was or could be in a person's life and affect their lives. So part of it was that I was seeing this idea of where somebody is at religiously or spiritually, and they are somewhat different, by the way, raising those ideas up to the whole to the same level as what do you do for your psoriasis? Or yes, your father had cancer at age 54. Let's talk about that. It's really part of the same picture, if you will. So part of in all honesty and in honesty with my patients when I'm sitting with them, where I happen to be at that moment is important. And something that we all can appreciate is that before we go from room one to room two, we have to sort of debrief ourselves or let a breath out, exhale, and empty ourselves a bit before we go to the next room. It's classic that we might enter the room and without knowing it, we become the important person in that room, not our patient. You know, maybe I'm thinking about the conversation I had 15 minutes before with a mom whose child we had just diagnosed with being on the spectrum. Or maybe the fact that I had a disagreement with my wife or my child before I got to work today. Maybe that's still weighing on me. In other words, we really need to be completely present for our patients. And so what I try to do each day is to prepare myself. And yes, it's somewhat deliberate. It's somewhat obsessive. But I find that it's very helpful. One is that I really try to get a decent night's sleep, and that's not always possible, particularly when we're on call or we have a child who's up all night or, you know, whatever. And then I try to eat as little breakfast as I can that's not too heavy, so my stomach's not weighted down during the morning hours. I try to have a good cup of coffee because I like coffee. And I try to take quiet time. And today I spent an hour, but I got up earlier. And I'm also not going to work today. I was just meeting with the boys at the coffee place. But I do try to take at least 15, 20 minutes. I might pray during that time. I might read something that's important to me. It might be a scripture. It might be something in the news that catches my eye that gets into my heart. And then I try to do something that's exercise. I live a mile from my office, so I ride my bike a lot. So that, to me, even a 10-minute ride is actually a fairly nice way to get my body going. So that, if you will, prepares me for that moment when I'm sitting with the patient. So when I ask Mrs. Smith about taking quiet time, it's coming from my heart. It's not coming from my head. And that's all the difference in the world. If I'm running down my list of review of systems, do you have headaches? Do you have sore throats? Do you have allergies? This list is kind of cumbersome and it's long. If I add number 42, do you have a prayer life? Do you have any spiritual life at all? It's not exactly going to be treated with the respect that it needs, basically. It's going to be treated with the respect of, no, I don't have sniffles. I don't have congestion, you know? So at that moment, when I reach into my heart to ask the question, I feel, like energetically, if you will, that the person receives it at that level. It's not coming from my head. Again, it's coming from my heart. And so I would love to have a video of how a person appears and how the voice changes when we are speaking from our heart as opposed to our head. Because I feel like most of us can tell. I mean, the way I'm speaking right now is definitely from this T4 area of my chest where the heart happens to lie, and not from C1 and 2 where my cranium happens to sit. And so the question is not only more sincere, but the reception of the answer is as well. And it also kind of sets the stage for the individual, the patient, Mrs. Smith, to respond in like. So it's a more honest response. And then, as we say, the space is created for a conversation. I recall talking to your class a few years ago when you guys were freshmen about this idea of the bubble, which I'll introduce here. Drum roll, the bubble. So the bubble is really a way to hyperfocus. It's a way to get into the same space as the patient. And what I do, because I think in pictures, and not everyone does, but we can do it in different ways for those listeners who don't see things as, when they say a word, they don't see that image in their head. But for those of us who do, I picture, and this is particularly useful, by the way, if I'm having difficulty focusing on the individual. If, for example, I'm still thinking about that child from the last visit 15 minutes before, I will create this envelope, if you will, like a bubble or a balloon, where the only people in that are myself and the patient, or the medical student, myself and the patient, the three of us. And the rest of the world basically can leave because it's just the three of us. It's almost like hiding out in a cave. You know, we've crawled into this cave, we've rolled the rock closed, and there's just the three of us or two of us sitting facing each other. And we know from functional MRI scans, the idea of mirroring, that when two people are in that kind of space, we're actually responding to each other at such a deep level that's unconscious. And you can look at the tracks, the neuro tracks through functional MRI scans and see that we're almost lining up. It's like the constellation that occurs in Mrs. Smith's brain is also occurring in mine. And so there we are. There's nobody else in our world but the two of us. And it's at that moment that we can really speak about very personal things and not feel judged, but instead feel loved. And I'll introduce the L word right now, because no matter how each of us view the word love, and I know in the English language we only have one word, in the Greek we have like five, and I'm sure in some cultures they have 20, we obviously need another word that explains the love that we can have for our patients, or they may have for us, because that love, again, is coming out of the cardiac, the heart, not from the head. And so at that level, the responses that we get when we ask questions come from a more sincere place and, on, you know, frankly, a more honest place. And so we can get much further in the conversation quicker when we're in that place. That's basically it.
It's poetic, it's beautiful, and it's very, very true. I have been privileged to be a part of that bubble as one of those medical students, and coming from that heart center, that place where love truly originates and is born. And, you know, people, I've been told this by many people, and but I still believe you were probably the first one, and certainly the first one that gave me the permission, but to walk in authenticity, completely right. In alignment with your core values, with your divine, whoever that is that you identify, you know, even if you don't believe in a God, but walk in alignment, be authentic, come from your heart, and people will know it. Unconsciously or consciously, they'll know it.
Right.
And if you just come into the room and say, "Oh, I heard that meditation might be helpful for you," but you can't take a half second in your life, people are going to know it. Consciously or unconsciously, right. They're going to pick up on, you know, the lack of authenticity.
Right.
And I've just realized that people, you know, resonate and will follow authenticity. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation and, you know, charlatans and just, you know, some amazing marketing that distorts some of that authenticity. But
amen.
At a very fundamental level, we, you know, as individuals and specifically as, you know, as clinicians, have to walk in that authenticity, allowing ourselves to be open and to resonate, because otherwise, you know, our patients, we won't connect. And I will never recommend something to one of my patients if I don't truly believe in it, and most often if I haven't done it myself. Right. Now, I can't sit there and pretend, say, someone has just recovered from heart attack.
Right.
I can't sit there and say, I know what it feels like, because right. I haven't had a heart attack. But I can enter that bubble. I can feel their pain. I can be with their suffering. It doesn't have to overcome me.
Right.
But I can recommend a process of mourning, of healing, that comes from my heart, comes from the place where I've, you know, legitimately tried it, or I've been in those places, and I know when I've recommended things that I don't fully believe in or I haven't really tried. And guess what? Usually the people don't really give them a go. And
don't.
I can't explain to you rationally or scientifically. I can't prove that, but you know, just from my sort of subjective experience, like that's when I know, like, oh, you know, I was out of alignment. I was recommending something because I saw it in a study that sounded cool. It sounded sexy.
Right.
And, so our deepest commitment, I think, you know, what we can do, like I said, as human beings and specifically as any healers in this profession is to walk with authenticity. And I've been blessed to be able to see that in your care. And once again, not being told what to do, but showing through example, this is how I walk in alignment. This right. is myself. You don't have to, please don't copy me. Please right. don't, you know, do everything that I do, but take from me this energy, see what you can provide. And I would love to kind of, you know, I've known you for about a year and a half, almost, you know, 2 years. And in that time, you've been such a wonderful mentor to me. And it's amazing to think you've been teaching students like myself for, oh goodness, like 25 years. And just the capacity to be that mentor, it astonishes me. It's something I am certainly wanting to dedicate part of my life to teaching, because I just see, like, you know, that's such a huge aspect of in this profession of healing is to pass on knowledge and to be teachers. And would love to maybe dive into aspects of what drew you to being a teacher, because you're in a community practice. You don't have any commitment. You don't need to be to be tied to the university and their students. But what drew you to teaching, and what have you found to be the most rewarding part of being a mentor?
So you mean I can't just say, Rob, that having a student look up to me and think, oh, isn't he great? And anything I say to that student is going to be accepted. I can't say that as the reason.
Something tells me there's something more.
Darn. Shoot, I got to think for a minute here. Teaching, I mean, those listening who have been teachers of any kind, and certainly all of us have had teachers all of our lives, know that it's not always easy, and that we've had great teachers and not so great teachers. And first I think, is having an intention to actually let someone learn from what we either say or what we do or both is important. It's certainly not a drudgery. Having a student lights me up. I actually have to express more than my typically more introverted self when I'm in the office. I have to speak out loud about what I'm thinking and how I'm thinking. So it allows me to look at how I do things, first of all, so that I kind of hone it, sharpen it a little bit for the student, but also I think it helps shape me. It allows me to, as I'm sitting there with the student and the patient, I can kind of sit as a little fly on the wall, if you will, and see what I'm saying, how I'm saying it. And because the student's doing that, as is the patient, but the student especially is watching. And it actually helps me develop my skills better. And additionally, obviously, if I'm teaching somebody about a particular issue, medical issue, it also helps me to understand what I know and don't know. And I will tell students at some point that I am not as sharp medically. You know, my acumen is not as sharp as it was the day I left my residency, which is my own mentor, Tom Townsend, told me this years ago, that that's the moment when you're the smartest as far as medical knowledge goes. The wisdom and the experience obviously shapes most of who we are as physicians down the road, if you will, in time. So yes, I will have forgotten which enzyme helps in the Krebs cycle to make an ATP. But at this point in life, as a physician, that's no longer important to me. What's important more is that I get the understanding, the relationship with the patient, and that's, I think, comes across with the students, and then that they actually understand how to ask the questions, how to get a more reliable answer from the patient, and then how to set up in our own heads a differential diagnosis based on what the patient's telling us, and then how to develop that and understand what we should do with that differential diagnosis, which could be, as listeners often know, 12, 15, 20 different ideas as to what could be causing this particular headache, for example. So to me, it's one of the greatest joys, and not everybody wants to do this. Frankly, my wife, Kathy, who's an optometrist, will take students on occasion, but it drains her a lot. And Kathy will see me come home from work and I'll be like pumped because I have a great student. We relate on many levels and I'm excited to be teaching that person something that they could use the rest of their lives. So yes, there are days which I'm not feeling that great. Perhaps I missed the coffee or I missed the meditation or I drove my car to work and I'm having a crappy morning. And so I'm not going to be as sharp to my patients as well as with my students as I could be. And that certainly happens too, because life is life. But it definitely, I'm lit up by having students. And those students can come from all kinds of places. I have DO students because I'm a DO. I have MD students because I'm down the street from UVA. I might have a nurse practitioner student or a PA student. To me, they're almost one and the same, except that obviously there's a big difference in the depth of knowledge that's acquired. And I have taught some residents, and I wish I did teach more because I think especially in residency, it's a time when the whole medical knowledge that was learned in school is now kind of set in place. Now it's learning more about the practice of medicine than the knowledge part. And I think that in some ways I can teach that better to them than I could teach, let's say, a medical student who's third year, who's just starting out looking at clinical medicine, who doesn't really need to know at that point how you manage a practice, for example, or how you manage to have 20 patients in one day and not burn out. You know, those are important more for the resident, for example, than for the third year medical student, if you will.
Yeah, I find, and I think it was perfect this past, this past winter, a few months ago, that you were able to be recognized for your dedication as a community preceptor. I know we joke that we must have convinced somehow, like drugged a few people or brainwashed a few people.
Brainwashed,
but
yeah.
You know, it's hard to argue when you look at some of the reviews, the evaluations, the experiences from folks who, you know, otherwise could have had just a normal, here's your family doctor, here's your internal medicine, a normal, you know, air quotes, normal experience. Mm-hmm. But they were just so happy to work with you because they started to approach patients differently. They thought about, you know, physiologic disturbances, pathological processes. They thought about things very differently. And it may not have changed anything they did immediately. You might not have, you know, given them like, well, when this person presents with X, you prescribe this drug. They might not leave with that medical knowledge, but they leave with a different way of thinking. And it'll come up. It'll, you know, they'll be on another rotation and all of a sudden that little voice, that way of thinking from Dr. Gelbert will come back. And I mean, I know just firsthand in talking with other students, and that cannot be faked. And it was just so heartwarming to be able to see you recognized for making such an impact in fellow students' lives. And, you know, I'm sitting here now and I could list off so many things that you've taught me, so much wisdom, so many practical skills. And I guess, you know, we've kind of answered it a little bit already in our discussion today, but what would be for, you know, anyone out there listening in the audience, what would be a very practical, you know, any practical skills or a practical approach to talk about spirituality, to talk about lifestyle as your gateway to health? And, you know, feel free to share, be as granular or as big picture as you want, but trying to be as, you know, as practical to really help people who were maybe a little afraid, as I was as a third year student, to engage in that conversation or didn't totally know how to do it.
Right. Well, thanks. Thanks for your compliments. I'm sitting over here squirming. I'm glad we're off the subject. So I think that for those of us listening who haven't had any type of serious endeavors into either religion or the spiritual world, if you will, I think probably the best way to look at it then is academic. And that might be, actually, I'm going to back up a little bit, partly academic, that if we read some studies in peer-reviewed journals about the effects of prayer, for example, on health, mental and physical, if we read some of these studies that are surveys, for example, about what people's beliefs are and how they might influence their recovery from surgery or from an illness, then we can kind of put that in the files with the rest of our medical knowledge that's talking about congestive heart failure or, you know, dermatitis, whatever else we've learned over the last 4 years of school or years of residency. So then it's put to the same level, and at least we can ask the questions because we know that it's important, even if we know it intellectually. But one of the things that you've done in the last few years for your fellow classmates is you've been sending them out this email once a week called CALM. And if people open that and even take 5 minutes to read it in the midst of their studies, they'll see that you acknowledge things like poetry, music, reading of prose, sitting outside, listening to a bird, sitting under a tree for a few minutes, that those are so important and as important as everything that we do as students or residents, that we spend hours and hours and hours per week. And so if students are doing that enough, they'll begin to appreciate that it's really important. And so sometimes when I ask people where they're at spiritually, they say, well, nature. And so that gets to this point very well, that if we can experience nature as something that's beyond us, that's outside of us, obviously, and that's so important in the world and to us personally, then from that place, from that space in ourselves, we can ask those questions to other people because we've lived them a little bit. You know, there's nothing like sitting with a practitioner who has either shared the things, as you mentioned earlier, that you're talking about, or who they have a knowledge at some level of my chief complaint, for example. I joke with patients who have allergies that before I took my homeopathic remedies 20 years ago, I could understand completely about what they were suffering with. And I'll say, you know, it always helps to have a physician who has the same issues you do, because then they completely understand it. They aren't going to discount what you're saying. And so by the same token, if you have a physician who has taken a walk in the last week, a hike, or sat down and listened to great live music, they're going to be listening to you better as your physician. They'll understand you when you mention something like, well, you know, I really need to chill because I'm so stressed. They'll appreciate that their physician who's just taken a hike that weekend can say, you know, I know you've got these things going on right now in your life, but you really need to take a half hour and just go for a stroll. That's all. Just go for a stroll. So that's kind of how I do it.
Nature is such a spiritual place to me. I think, you know, even as a Christian, we sometimes can get very nearsighted and say, well, you know, my spirituality takes place in a church. And,
right.
You know, the world, the universe is that church. And, you know, for many people, including myself, I mean, nature was my initial gateway to exploring any aspects of my spirituality.
Right.
And to think that we could ever hold any aspect of our religion or spiritual beliefs into one setting is really myopic. And and I agree with you, just being, if you are that doctor who during your lunch break, you take a 10, 15 minute walk just to be outside in silence, not only is that going to help you as an individual, it's going to carry over into the people you see, and you will bring in a different energy to the exam room. And I guess, you know, to bring things to some degree of, you know, closure, you know, because we could sit here talking the whole day, and we've had done that on many occasions.
That's right.
I mean, just being in Haiti with you brings back some wonderful memories. And to bring things to a close, I guess I want to give you these last few minutes to share any piece of parting wisdom or a story that you think will resonate with anyone in our audience. And I know it's like, man, I could talk about anything, but I really do want to give this open space to allow you to share any last thoughts of wisdom, any last stories.
I think I'm going to give you a 2-minute story about failure and forgiveness. And this is a mistake I made about 20 years ago that, you know, it still haunts me, but I think it's an important lesson for me and maybe for the listeners. So I hope I can do this in 2 minutes. So this gentleman was in his 80s, and he had stage 4 heart failure, which means that he could get across the room, but that was about it. And he was a gentle guy and a great guy. He had a great sense of humor. And he was on Coumadin, which some of you know is warfarin, which is rat poison. And it actually, if you will, thins our blood. And it has probably more interactions with other drugs than any other drug I know of, because of the enzyme that it works on, or that works on it in the liver. And I handed him samples of a drug called Biaxin, which is used for sinus infections and other things. And it had just come out, like, in my mind, it came out the week before, because the drug reps dropped off samples. And did I read the PI, the package insert? No. So I gave him a 10-day course of Biaxin for his sinus infection. And about 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from the ICU at UVA down the street saying that one of my patients was in the hospital. And so I walk in the room. The medical student is standing there. And I said, what happened to Jack? He says, oh, his primary care doctor gave him Biaxin and interacted with his Coumadin. And he basically bled. He had a hemorrhagic stroke. So there's Jack on a ventilator. And he died a couple of days later. So I looked at the med student and said, well, that doctor is me. And about 3 weeks later, after Jack died, I called his wife, who I didn't know that well because she wasn't a patient of mine. And she did come in once in a while with her husband. And I said, you know, I caused this. I caused this cascade of events that killed your husband. I just want you to know that. And she looked at me and she said, Greg, it's okay, actually, because it was his time. I forgive you. In that moment, I realized what grace is. It's the grace that I believe I feel from God, and it's the grace that we can give any one of us, each other, when we've made a mistake.
Well, I don't think there's really anything else to say. It's an incredibly touching story, one that I think a lot of us would rather not have in our archives,
right.
But an incredibly touching story of vulnerability and forgiveness. And so thank you, Greg, for sharing this time, this conversation, your stories. You know, I feel each day I think I know you 100%. And then there's still another story and another story. And I know there'll be many, many more stories. And I'm just excited to be able to continue in this field with you by my side. And I hope our audience can take a few of these pieces of wisdom and stories and bring them into their own lives. And so thank you.
You're welcome, Rob. You inspire me, yourself. And I'm excited with your new career, and I'm excited that you understand people, God, and the practice of medicine so well at this young age.
Well, I think it's time. Go grab some lunch.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your presence and willingness to receive a new narrative, a passionate perspective, and perhaps a deeper sense of connection with our collective purpose. Please share this podcast with any and all that you believe will benefit from its intention to relieve one's doing and engage one's being. Please share your comments about the conversation on our podcast page and leave a review in iTunes so that the voices in this space can spread to all ears ready to receive it. Music credit goes to Dillingham for their song Vessel. Remain open, stay curious, and forever be love. You walked on fire, and I know you tried.